I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Good Glow Podcast. Following a cancer diagnosis in my 30s, my goal is to inspire and empower people on their self-care journey. Through the conversations I have with my guests, we hope to do just that.
There is a plan, and believe that if you're at rock bottom and you're suffering, this is all part of your life, your tapestry. This is your story, and where you go next is what's crucial.
The love before was easy, but the love at my lowest was real.
We all know what makes us happy. We all know the life we dreamed about. And deep down, we all know what we're capable of if you only give yourself permission to do it.
I now live a healthy and fulfilled life where self-care is a top priority and every day is an opportunity to grow. This season, I'm so proud to say I've teamed up with Vichy. Vichy is an expert French pharmacy dermocosmetic brand. Doctor-founded Vichy has established the link between health and beauty and led the way in skincare innovation for 90 years. Powered by active ingredients, all product formulations are clinically proven, hypoallergenic and dermatologically tested for sensitive skin, making Vichy a pioneer in skin health science. Taking a holistic approach to skin health, Vichy is committed to provide safe and effective skincare routines for every skin type at every life stage. All Vichy products are available in local pharmacies nationwide. Hello, I hope you are well. I am so excited to start season 10 of the Good Glow podcast today. I cannot believe we're into season 10, but I have so much coming your way over the next few weeks. For example, I'm speaking to Debs Walker, who is an Irish mum who found a 3-month-old baby boy on the side of the road 3 weeks after arriving to start a new life in Texas. That story will give you chills. I speak to Dave Gilna, who survived after he was struck by a bolt of lightning on his J1 in Boston. And I speak to Dr. Libby Weaver, who's a women's health expert who'll be on the podcast to give us easy, actionable tips on how we can live a better, healthier life. And so honored to speak to Dr. Libby on my podcast, and she has so much to share with us. But today I'm starting with Kagi Dunlop. I'm sure lots of you remember Kagi from Made in Chelsea. Well, she's gone on an incredible journey over the last few years, and what really struck me when I was editing this podcast was her openness and her knowledge in the area of wellness. It's so clear that she's done a lot of work over the past few years. So we speak about her becoming sober curious. She wrote an article for Glamour magazine that I'd encourage everyone to go read earlier this year. She speaks about how we can become our authentic self. We talk about tribes and finding like-minded people. Really inspiring stuff. And she also speaks about all of her ups and downs over the past few years. So there's so much in there. Before we get into it, I just wanted to mention that my show in the National Concert Hall is back on after 2 years. November 2nd is the date. As I said, we booked the show almost 2 years ago, and plans for this show have really evolved over the last year or two. And I'm really aware that this is going to be a first night out for many people, an emotional night, I'm sure. So I've packed it full of brilliant guests, really inspiring stuff. We're going to have live music. I think we've all missed it so much. And I really want people to leave the concert hall feeling so inspired and so uplifted. So that show was sold out, but we have released a very, very small batch. I think there's under 50 tickets that have gone up this week. So head over to nch.ie and search for The Good Glow if you want to get a ticket, and I will see you there. So let's get into it. I can't wait for your feedback on this podcast. Please feel free to leave me a review if you enjoy it, and I'll talk to you very soon. Kagi, I've been a big fan of yours for years. Thank you so much for coming on The Good Glow today. I just came into the studio, actually, and I said to the guys here, I have Kagi Dunlop on the podcast. And they were all like, oh my God, I love Kagi. They were. they love your podcast. So thanks for your time. You're back with a new season. You know, the world is going back to normal a bit, kind of. How are you feeling, and where is your head at these days?
Wow. Okay. So many points that I have on that, because it's actually weirdly a question that I haven't been asked, But I've been thinking about it a lot because, of course, things are normalizing, like life is resuming to somewhat how it used to be for the first time in a very long time. And with that, obviously, there's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of things happening. There's a lot of socializing. But I've definitely noticed that I have sort of post-pandemic effects that I think everyone will be experiencing. But, you know, just to share some of mine, I think I've become a lot weirder for the last 2 years. Maybe I always was really weird and I've just really like lent into it. But I'm so much more sensitive to other people's energies, and I'm a creature of solitude anyway. And so for me, the last, you know, being in lockdown actually wasn't that hard. Obviously, I struggled with it sometimes, but I'd say compared to like the average person who needs to socialize quite a lot, I didn't find it that difficult. So I'm finding that slightly challenging. But that being said, I'm also feeling very hopeful that, you know, I think now in the run up to Christmas is going to be a little bit wobbly. I think everyone's still like, is this permanent? What's going to happen? Are we going to be put back in a box? How do we feel? Do we trust people? Do we trust the government? Yeah. And then I'm hoping that at the beginning of next year, we sort of see like a more, yeah, shift. But a lot's going on. Even sort of astrologically, a lot's going on. I mean, I would, if I tried to explain that, I'd butcher it. But
but I think like even when I'm chatting to my friends now, it seems like there's almost a lot of emotions that we are still kind of carrying from the last 18 months. Like, yeah. I think, you know, I go forest bathing sometimes. And I remember I went forest bathing after the first lockdown and I kind of took a minute to acknowledge what had happened mm-hmm. in the first lockdown and congratulate myself for getting through that. So I think there's definitely kind of this transitional period now where people are like, okay, we're going back to normal, but I do think it's really important to acknowledge what we've been through. And like in those lockdowns, did you feel loneliness at times?
So I had a really interesting conversation with someone yesterday about the sort of the astrology behind 2020, and to kind of connect it to what we're talking about, I think I went through, I guess, a dark night of the soul when I was probably 27. I think that that's why I started this show and why I'm like passionate about this space. But in a way, I think collectively we've just gone through one. So I think we've experienced this collective grief that really we've never had in our lifetime, definitely, because obviously we're so like in our linear minds going about our day to day, busy, busy, busy. And then suddenly this thing happens that's like incredibly unifying, but also whether we're conscious of it or not, we are experiencing a collective energy because we are being impacted by the same thing for the first time, you know, ever. You know, it's like when an announcement is made, when something happens, it's like we all are feeling it at the same time. And so I think we're really tapping into the collective consciousness in a way that we haven't perhaps before, which is both a good thing, but also to be acknowledged that, like you said before, there's a lot of stuff that we're experiencing that's all personal and collective. And I think it's important to try and differentiate between the two. But to go back to your point about solitude, I think that I learned that solitude was medicinal for me long before the pandemic. And so I was actually writing yesterday about the difference between solitude and loneliness. As a society, we view loneliness as like, don't want to be lonely, fill your space up all the time with friends, with dates, with technology. Whereas I actually really encourage people to invite space into their lives. And that can feel uncomfortable at first, but when you do, not only does that allow like ideas to come to the surface, it allows you to feel and express what's going on. It allows you to experience grief if you need to. And so I don't really get lonely.
And those moments when you are alone and you're working through things, what sort of practices do you turn to? Is it like meditation, yoga? Is it just stillness in general? Or,
well, it's okay. So I don't feel lonely in the sense that I am so comfortable in my own company to the point where it can be problematic. Like, as in, I'm very okay with the idea that it's just me forever. Like, I'm like, if I never meet someone and I don't have that sort of traditional framework, I'm totally fine with that. And I genuinely mean it. But I've done a lot of work around, you know, just being on my own. And, but I'm a creature that's very, very, very tactile. My love language is touch. So that is the piece that I do miss. And that's not like, that is really just company of someone, you know, of like my best friend moved back to America over the pandemic, and we're both very, you know, we'll just like lie on the sofa hugging each other. And so that's what I crave. And I would say that that's the piece where I feel lonely, is like from a physical comforting point where you just want to be held. It's a very primal animalistic thing. So I don't get lonely, but I do get like physical loneliness.
Yeah. And do you, I was speaking to my friend Claire Solon last season. She lives in London. She's 40, she's single, and she really believes that there is somebody out there for her, and she refuses to settle. So is that kind of the way that you think about things? You know, it would be so easy for you to find a boyfriend. I'm sure you just walk out your front door. But are you, I presume you're a person who won't settle.
100%, absolutely not. Because I think for me, especially over the last year, it's been this sort of reckoning of, historically, I've always abandoned myself in relationship. And that's not to put on the other person. That is just something that I picked up as like a societal thing, that I needed to fall into a certain female archetype of being the good girl, of being the girlfriend, of like molding myself to somebody else. And I think I've really cultivated a life for myself over the last couple of years that is very much my own. And I guess I'm quite territorial of that. I'm quite enjoying my autonomy. That's not to say I'm not open. I'm just not searching. And I think there's like quite a difference there. It's like I am dating at the moment. I am dating someone. It's early days, but also like I'm not, there's a very toxic narrative around women in their early 30s that's like your shelf life is sort of disintegrating before your before your eyes, and it creates this this need to settle. And I think that it's, you know, I'd say that's the one thing I get the most messages about, is young women saying, I'm 30, I'm 27, I'm 28, I'm 29, I'm 34, whatever, saying I'm single and I'm terrified I'm never going to find someone. And I find that bizarre, because I'm like, life is so long.
So long.
Like, what? Why would you rush at that age just because society tells you to then end up with the wrong person and have to go through all that pain and its demise, which inevitably you will.
And also life can change in a split second. And like when you were saying there about, you know, abandoning yourself in certain relationships. And I think a lot of people will be able to relate to that. I certainly can, you know, relationships that I had earlier in my life. At what point in your life did you kind of become aware of that, or really get to know yourself and kind of reflect back and see that that was happening?
I think I always did it. And it was probably because I hadn't really established who I was enough. Or I always kind of based who I was off the person I was with. And that's like a deeper issue that I sort of got from a young age, of being like, oh, who do I need to be for the world to accept me? And then, of course, when it came to like meeting a romantic partner, I'd be like, okay, who do I need to be for them to accept me? And I would say it was probably my last serious relationship when I started really leaning into these practices and, you know, cultivating like these behaviors and these things that felt very anchoring for me. And then when the relationship ended, I noticed that I didn't feel that same sense of like, oh, well, I don't know who I am anymore. I actually did. So it was like both, you know, a great sadness, but also I felt like a small victory because I was like, I'm still standing, you know, and I had all these things that I could lean on to go through that heartbreak, which I don't think I could have handled it. I wouldn't have handled it like in a very healthy way if I hadn't had those things. And so I guess it was then, and from that point, I really became committed to that space and, you know, the being committed to the process of my becoming, I guess. And then, you know, anyone else along the way is like, yeah.
Was there a moment, like there was a huge shift in my life through my illness when I was 32, that I was like, I can no longer live the way I was living. Like it was making me so ill. And I felt like I'd come to a crossroads. And in many ways, I felt like I had no option but to change because so much had gone wrong for me at that point. But so when there's no illness there, or there's no kind of sudden kind of crisis to make you change, what do you think helped you get to know yourself, or what was the moment that you decided?
Well, that's the thing about, you know, spiritual awakenings. Unfortunately for the listeners, there is no, I don't think, any way of like bypassing the rock bottom.
Yeah.
It is a case of like death and rebirth. But that doesn't have, you know, obviously you had your experience of it that you say really forced you to change. But I definitely had things that it wasn't an option to carry on, because I think the way I'd been behaving very hedonistically, and I was, you know, drinking, I was doing drugs, I was just like not, and it wasn't to say that I was more extreme than the average person, but it was impacting me perhaps more. Or I had this awareness of it that I was like, why am I doing this to myself? And it felt 100% like a rock bottom.
And was this your life after Made in Chelsea then, in that time period? Right.
I'd say that kind of like was a version of myself, again, to kind of echo what I just mentioned, of I thought that that's who I needed to be in the world. Like that's from growing up, I kind of observed people like, you know, even within my family, I was like, I think if I'm this person, that will be what they want.
Yes.
And then I'd say Made in Chelsea was like a perfect manifestation of those desires. So it's interesting that that came into reality, no pun intended. But of course, as soon as I was like actually living or trying to live that way, it felt so inauthentic and out of alignment that I was very reckless, because I think I was at odds with myself.
I think in Made in Chelsea, and I was thinking about this the other day, I was thinking about your character. Like you were such a lovable character. You were the sweetheart. You weren't the villain in Made in Chelsea. Did that make things easier that everyone was on your side?
Well, I'd say, I hope that that's just like a part of who I am that came through on the show. But yeah, definitely. But at the same time, I think that it doesn't matter what is going on in people's external worlds if their internal world is in chaos. It doesn't matter. You could have like all the success, all the money, all the fame, but if internally you aren't at peace, you will destroy it. You will want to reflect what's happening internally, externally, whether you're conscious of it or not. And so I would say that I, at that time, wanted to just run away, I think, from myself.
And what did your rock bottom moments look like, Kagi?
It wasn't like one particular one, like, you know, something happened to me or anything. It was just an accumulation of things over time that I was like, okay, this behavior is destructive. So why am I still doing it? And there was definitely one moment in LA, because I was living in LA when I was 27, and I was trying so hard to control my life. Like I became really attached to this particular trajectory of how I thought things needed to go. And it just what like it just wasn't working. And I just remember being on the phone to my mum and pulling over the car and having, you know, one of two, I've only had two anxiety attacks in my life, and that was the first one. And just feeling like totally out of control, but still desperately just trying to like keep my head above water kind of feeling. And that was definitely a turning point a little bit, because at that I was kind of like, okay, like show me, you know.
And, you know, Oprah speaks about that. I was reading her book or listening to one of her masterclasses, and she was saying that there was a part in this film that she really wanted, and she was, you know, so consumed by it. Woke up every day, was thinking about it. Why aren't they ringing me back? Why aren't I getting the part? And she was just holding it so closely. Mm. And then one day she woke up and she said, you know, I'm just going to let this go. And if it happens, it happens. But, you know, I have to like detach myself from the outcome a little bit. Mm-hmm. And as soon as she did, she got the part. But it's funny, isn't it? Like often when I really want things, or I really want, you know, a kind of a work thing to work out in a certain way or a career thing, I'm like, I need to stop just putting all my attention on this thing, because the universe is going to take me wherever it's going to take me, yeah. You know, and I need to stop resisting the path that I am supposed to be on.
Absolutely. And that's the thing. It's that lesson of not only trust in the universe, but trust in yourself. And I think we think it's an illusion that we have control at all, but we like to think that we're in the driving seat of our life, but we're really, really not. And I think when you can learn to let go and to surrender, you allow things to unfold as they're supposed to. But of course, it's a lot easier to say it than it is to action it and do it. It's like when people say, if someone really wants a relationship, and is like desperate to find someone, and people go, oh, you'll never find them when you're looking, so stop looking. It's like a frustrating thing to say, because you're like, well, I really want it, so it's where all my focus is going. But it is true. It's like if you can redirect that and kind of just be like, okay, show me. And, you know, I think that's the kind of beauty of your Saturn return, is when you are through the other side, you look out through that vantage point and you go, oh, I'm so glad that fell apart, and I'm so glad that I didn't get that job, and I'm so glad that that friendship group like disappeared or whatever, because I am who I am right now, and I'm who I'm supposed to be. And so there's obviously a discomfort in that, and a grief and a process where we're shifting, we're emerging as something new, and that can be really painful.
And what was your time in LA like? Did you discover a lot about yourself over there?
Yeah, because I spent a huge amount of time on my own. I think at that point, I was like, okay, I don't want to play this role of like, everyone has to like me. Because I kind of created this character that would come to life mainly when I was drinking. And it was like this party girl people pleaser, and that kind of, even though everyone like, let's say, liked me hopefully on Main Chelsea, that was still sort of my reputation, because that's how I was behaving, and that's I guess how I wanted to be perceived. But when I went to LA, I was like, okay, that's not going to work anymore, because it's just not progressive for like what I want to do in life. Like I'm draining myself for the validation of others. Like, what is that about? So I started to spend like a lot of time on my own, and I really focused on like the things that I wanted to achieve really in life. Like I was like, okay, really, like what are the goals here? And for me, they're always quite creative things. And I was very focused on music, which actually gave me discipline in a way that I'd never had it before, because I had something to focus on that meant that I couldn't go out and that I couldn't, you know, do all these things, because I had to look after my voice and I had to be in the studio all night and all that kind of thing. So my behavior definitely changed quite dramatically when I was there. And also I was free from the version that people knew me to be. And I think that's a really challenging one for people listening. It's like when you feel that call that you need to change, or you need to like come home to a version of yourself that you've viewed like society has told you that it's not acceptable, but you suddenly have this urge to to reawaken that side. I think when you're in a friendship group or whatever it might be that enjoys or needs you to be the destructive version of you, or a version that you've kind of outgrown, it can be really difficult. Because of course, you know, there's this beautiful piece, I think it's from this book called Belonging by Toko Partana, which is about how when our need for belonging is threatened by our need for authenticity, we will abandon our authenticity to feel like we belong.
Yeah.
So we will, to stay in the community, to stay in the group, to stay in the tribe, we will cut away like our true essence because it's a survival thing. But that's also outdated. You know, that frame of mind doesn't need to exist anymore. So I think it's about being brave enough to kind of step into the void a little bit. And just trust that the people will find you. I get so many messages from people saying like, oh, I want to, you know, be more like this and do the stuff, but I don't know how I'm going to make friends or what people are going to think of me. And I do think that there's like a necessary part in between where, let's say, you might feel a bit lonely. But then the right people do show up, and I can't tell you how or why, but I'm telling you they just do.
Oh my God, like my heart as you're saying this is like beating really fast because I'm like, yes, yes, yes. my husband Jamie was diagnosed with MS in 2012, and he spoke about this in an interview recently that he kept that a secret. So only our family knew and his best friends. He had a big job, you know, he was a leader at work. And he didn't want people to know that he had been diagnosed with MS because he felt like, you know, I have to be the strong one. I want to be the person that people come to with their problems. And he didn't want to be different. And this had happened to him and he was dealing with all of this. We dealt with this for a secret for 8 years. And sometimes I wished he could just shout it from the rooftops because I felt like I wasn't being authentic because I couldn't say, you know, I'm suffering here. My husband has MS, you know, this is what we've been through. Like my best friend, who's like my sister, Audrey, she didn't even know. So when he came out, he said that it was like, in the tribe, we want to be accepted. We want to all be the same. And you're afraid to step out and say, sorry, I have MS, because you're afraid that your tribe is going to reject you, when in fact, your tribe will put their arms around you and protect you and help. And yes. Yeah. So when you were saying that, it is so true. I think for so many people listening, that their heart and their soul is telling them something. Because it's so scary to take that leap and say, sorry, this is who I am, or this is the direction I want to go in. Like even for me, exercising, I was so embarrassed in my recovery from cancer to start exercising because I'd never done it before. And I was like, people are going to laugh at me and say, you don't exercise, you're not that type of person. When in fact, nobody did that. But it's so hard, isn't it, to take the leap?
Yeah, and it's the thing, because it's what we all, like you say, it's like within our soul, it's what we all crave. And I think that today's world has made it even more problematic because our tribe is so big, because our tribe is social media. It's the whole fucking world, excuse my French. So it's not just like your village or your small community that you have to speak up. People feel like it's, you know, you say something online and you can have like, anybody that has like even 50 followers could wake up and suddenly that have gone viral, you know, and then them being villainized. So it's creating like even more fear than there already was about speaking our truth. And so there's this massive disconnection that's happening. But I think it's really important for people that are listening, rather than like the focus being on the public facing self, because it's far too outbalanced at the moment. It's like, okay, how do I feel within me? How do I feel in my soul and my values? And this person I spoke to yesterday told me this thing. He was like, if you can't look in the mirror and look in your own eyes and say, I love you. It's like, you should not be saying anything on social media to anybody, like as in like having a go, because seriously, like you've got shit to work out about yourself before you start projecting through your own echo chamber. And so I think that, you know, for people listening, it's like really tapping into that truthful part and then sharing that with a small few. It's the most powerful thing. And I've had experiences over the last year where I've shared very deep and personal things that I wouldn't, that I've never shared with anyone, with like my bestest friends, and being held, like it makes me emotional now, being held in that by them, having that community and having that sisterhood has been the biggest gift I've ever been given. And that was the most interesting thing, to kind of go back to what we were talking about at the beginning. It's like, I always valued a romantic partnership as being the person that was going to like save me. And it wasn't, it was my friends.
And Kagi, are these lifelong friends or friends that you've met along your journey?
Friends I've met along my journey that are lifelong friends now.
Wow. Okay, I love it. I'll get straight back to my conversation with Kagi. But first, I wanted to thank Vichy for supporting the Good Glow and tell you all about their new hero product, Mineral 89 Probiotic Serum. I've been using this over the past few months and I absolutely love it. Recently, through working with Vichy and speaking to their skincare experts, I learned that stress can actually affect our skin and how it looks. Over the past few years, I've certainly learned about the importance of de-stressing. So what can we do for our skin? Well, Vichy's new Mineral 89 Probiotic Serum targets acutely stressed skin and supports the repair of skin barrier damage. Mineral 89 Probiotics is proven to visibly improve dullness, elasticity, stress lines, and overall radiance for the recharge of stressed skin needs. It's dermatologist tested, hypoallergenic, and fragrance free. It can be used every morning and night after cleansing your skin before your moisturizer. For a 20% Mars Pharmacy discount on Mineral 89 Skin Booster and Mineral 89 Probiotic Fraction Serum, use the code GOODGLOW20 online only at mars.ie until November 30th. It's hard, isn't it, as an adult sometimes to make friends. And I was buying tickets to this Soul Space show here in Ireland. It's a guy called Jerry Hussey, and he speaks from the heart and helps so many people kind of work through things. And I was like, that would be a great show to go to by yourself, because you could then be introduced to people, you know, who are on the same journey as you or a similar journey. And that's it. That's the start of your little tribe then, that you can kind of, even going for a sea swim or joining a swim club, that you're going to meet kind of like-minded people along the way.
This was a huge thing for me. And I think that this is what people struggle with, because they'll be hearing this and they're going, I want that, but I'm scared to do it on my own. Because if you do kind of have to. And when I was a kid, literally, I would not do anything on my own. My mum would be like, you're going to, you know, tennis club, whatever. Like, I need a friend. Like, I can't go on my own. I was just so terrified all the time. But that was a massive thing that I started doing. I was like, just saying yes to things. If someone like I just met invited me to like a moon ritual, I was like, sure. And now I love doing things on my own. Even when I went through, you know, the breakup that I just mentioned a moment ago, I then was like, I just need to go back to my spirit home, which is Australia. And I just went for like pretty much a month on my own, stayed on my own. And I had the best time, because I was just able to tap in and out of things. I had some friends there. I like did my own thing and I just walked, and it was just so soul nourishing. And I do think, you know, it's by doing those things and stepping out a little bit and being able to be vulnerable and show up that, you know, you'll meet people. You have to do those things that, like you say, you know your tribe's going to be at them. You're going to meet more like-minded individuals. And of course, it is a bit scary and it's not always going to be great, but you've kind of got to risk it to win it.
I love that. I love the way there's more kind of wellness shows on now. Like you were saying, you've announced a tour, like you'll probably find that loads of people, you know, will come to that by themselves and connect. Your community will connect with each other. I think that's the great side of social media, is that you can build this community and then friendships can be formed within that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's really one of my missions now going forward, is because obviously everyone listens to the podcast usually in their own space and in individual experience, but so many of them are messaging me saying the same things. I'm like, I need to just bring you guys all together because they're all so like-minded, and it especially when you're just starting to feel these things or have these realizations, it can feel quite isolating and lonely. But I'm like telling everyone, like, and so you'll know this as well, like so many people at the moment are kind of waking up.
Mm. There's a huge awakening. And when you wrote that piece for Glamour magazine in January, it was it was amazing. It was very powerful. And you spoke about how being sober, curious, transformed your mental health. Yes. And I think, you know, I was chatting to the guys in the studio before I came on just about that piece that you wrote. And I think sober, curious is a great phrase, isn't it? Because I think we're all kind of leaning in a little bit towards that. And to talk us through that piece and putting that together.
So that was probably one of the biggest components to my mental health, but also, you know, the way that I was hitting these rock bottoms, that was my tool for self-destruction. And because it's so normalized in society that that's what people do. That's what you do when you go out. That's what you do when you go on dates. And sometimes my drinking was fine, but sometimes it would get out of control. And I think it became so wrapped up in this version of me that I put out to the world, that when I was in that mode, I wasn't thinking about anything else. I was just like wanting to entertain, be liked, be adored, never let the party end kind of thing. And so when I like to untangle that and actually be able to be like, okay, can I be the person that like doesn't drink at a party and goes home early? And how does that feel? And to sit with that discomfort. And it took a lot of trial and error of like, I made sure that I went to things. I showed up at all, like, think, whereas before I just wouldn't go out, and I went to things and I would not drink. I'd feel a bit weird and I'd go home and I'd feel like a bit weird. And then I'd wake up and I'd feel really good. And I was like, oh, okay, this is the victory that I'm looking for rather than like the applause. And so once I started to focus on that, it became a lot easier. And then I sort of retrained that muscle memory. And I think it was, you know, I listened to Ruby Warrington's Sober Curious podcast. So she sort of coined the term, and she just interviews loads of people who are sober and just speaks about this idea that, you know, it doesn't have to be this binary, oh, I'm in AA, like I'm completely sober, or oh, I'm a normal person that drinks normally, I say in sort of, you know, brackets. So when I realized that actually there was something in between, that really resonated for me, because I'm not someone that's an alcoholic or that can't drink. It just doesn't agree with me on a spiritual level. And I can go into, you know, the details of what I mean by that if you want me to in a moment. So sober curiosity was like this thing that allowed me to, you know, invite sobriety into my life that didn't feel like it was a sort of sentence, you know, like a oh, well, that's what you've got to be forever. Because, of course, in the past, when I'd done periods of sobriety and then I'd have a drink, I'd usually go completely crazy, because it would, in my mind, be like, oh, well, you've broken your sobriety and you failed. So I think really, you know, I encourage people to not do that, because it's a process, and it's like very personal, one's relationship to alcohol. It's not this like one size fits all. And I think we all need to have a lot more understanding and empathy that, like, If drinking doesn't work for me, no one has the right to question why.
Mm. And you spoke on your podcast before about stumbling across an AA meeting in LA.
Yes, yes.
I loved that story.
It was the craziest, like, such a me story. But it was like someone's super famous son or something. He was like, yeah, I'm, you know. And we met literally buying like some vegan food at Air One. And he was like, do you want to come sit with me? And then said, you know, I'm going on my way to an AA meeting. Why don't you come? And being English, I didn't know how to say no. So next thing you know, it was in where Grease was filmed. You know, Grease the film.
It was
the old school. I mean, it was like such an LA experience. So we went into like the old theater. I was like, is this guy gonna kill me? Like, what's going? I'm walking along with my coconut, and then we go into this theater, and there's like an AA meeting happening, and I remember just, you know, it was a sobering experience because I remember just being so shocked by how it had affected, how alcohol had affected these people in a way that felt like every morning for them was a battle, you know? Mm. And my heart really went out to them because it, you know, when it gets to that point, when it becomes that much of a monster, it's awful. And I've had friends and family that have experienced that. But I was just like, that is not going to be me. And who knows whether it could have been. Mm. But I was just going to make damn sure that that never happened. And so for me to have like control over that part of my life and be like, nah, it doesn't work.
And did you have to speak or anything at that meeting, or were you able to kind of?
Thankfully not.
Okay.
Because they were going around and just pointing at people. I was like, oh, what do I say? I'm actually not an alcoholic. I'm just here. He'd be like, get out.
And when people talk to you about Made in Chelsea, do you stiffen up? How do you feel about the experience? Yeah,
I do. It's got better, but it always creates this like tightness in my chest that I'm like, oh, please, can we not?
Yeah.
I think because also it's like I've just talked about it so much.
Mm.
And you know, in the sort of the and I get it, like it was the most significant thing that I did. I was known for that, but in terms of like my life, it was just quite a small chapter, but it's become such an identity piece to everyone I speak to about it that it's kind of confusing, because I'm like, it's like me saying, so tell me about that class you had at school when you were 19, yeah, like 18 or something. You're just being like, why does everyone still care? But I guess, you know, that is what happens when you do a reality TV show when you're young. But the beauty of it as well is like, my youth will forever be immortalized, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I don't know.
Because I was speaking to Louise Thompson and she was saying that, you know, for her, like it was quite a toxic experience and it took her a long time to kind of heal from her experience on Made in Chelsea. And of course, it brought great things to her life as well. But it's certainly something that she has acknowledged and I think moved on from. And I'm sure for a lot of the cast, you know, it's probably time to move on.
It's time. It's time, everyone. Sorry.
You speak about Australia. Is that where you feel the most connected to?
Yes. That is, I mean, there's a thing called astrocartography that sort of shows a mapping of places in the world where you have sort of connections. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And someone that was doing, I don't know if you've heard of Human Design, but she was doing my Human Design and she also does that. And I'd said that I had this very, very, very strong connection with Sydney. And she went away and looked up my birth chart within astrocartography and saw that this line goes directly through Sydney, which is supposedly where you feel like you have this soul connection, which I found really fascinating.
Wow.
Because it's been, I mean, I went there when I think I was 12, maybe a bit younger, with my family. And it was like falling in love. Like the feeling I have there is really quite magical and unique, like nothing I've ever experienced anywhere else in the world. So it's definitely my spiritual home.
Wow. And how could people look up to see where theirs is?
I don't actually know if there's a web. I'm sure there is. If you just type in astrocartography, okay, and then you probably, let me just see. It's how the placements of the planet affect the energies we feel in certain places we live or visit. It's really interesting. And you can just look it up online. You need your time of birth, I think.
That's so cool. Thank you so much for your time. One more question. What is it, a day in the life of Kagi now? I'm always interested to know what people's routines are. Does it change from day to day for you?
Every day is quite different, but I'm pretty routine in the sense that I wake up naturally with the sun. So I'm kind of up at like, well, I don't know. People be like, that's not when the sun comes up, but I always am up before seven. I don't like setting an alarm. I just wake up and I will get up and I will start working pretty much straight away. I'll make a cup of tea and have a banana. I'm very much like a morning person. And that's when I like feeling like I'm starting before the rest of the world has a little bit. Obviously, a lot of people get up really early, so they're like, that's not that early. But it feels early enough for me. And yeah, we'll do kind of admin, do, you know, organization stuff. At the moment, we just have so much going on. So I feel like a lot of the day is just consumed by getting everything organized, whether that's content, podcast research, guest booking, stuff for the blog. So that does take up a lot. And then I'm going to go and spend some time with a friend in Brixton this evening. So every day is totally different, which I love because I'm not someone that could do the same thing every day. But yeah, I just try and make sure I carve out enough time to just also be still, which is hard. It's not always possible.
Oh, it's so hard to be still.
Yeah, I mean, I try because usually in the afternoon is when I kind of hit a bit of a like tired point. And that's when I usually will put on, I don't know if you've heard of Beautiful Chorus, but it's this gorgeous band, I guess a band, but they just sing this spiritual music and it's super healing.
Oh, nice.
And I just listen to that and I just like sit on the sofa or like lie on the sofa and just breathe and really like connect into my body and check in on myself and just like see where I'm at, because otherwise I think we can just burn out so easily.
What was that the name of that group called?
Beautiful Chorus.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, I'm gonna look them up. One book, just if you could recommend just one book for people to read that may be listening today.
Women Who Run With Wolves.
Okay, amazing. Kagi, you got back to me straight away. You've done so much for me. I appreciate you so much. And thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on the Good Glow today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I've loved it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Good Glow podcast, brought to you with thanks to Vichy. If you did, please feel free to leave me a review and subscribe. As I said at the start of the podcast, there is a very small amount of tickets available for my National Concert Hall show on November 2nd, available over on nch.ie. I'll see you next week.